This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
Hello and welcome to the bite-sized business breakfast, the very best bits of today's show from Wednesday, August the 4th, lovingly put together by the very patient producer Shruti Rajendran. Morning, Shruti.
Morning.
Whatever you're paid is not enough to put up with us, like, I'll tell you that. Now, good show this morning. We're going to start off with Serena Kelly, who's got lots of details on the travel restrictions between here and Nigeria, India, Pakistan being. The restrictions are loosening a little bit, aren't they?
Yes, it's more about applying for a permit, waiting for it to come through before you can actually travel. And of course, there are other restrictions like having been vaccinated, having a valid visa, etc.
Yeah, so many questions on this that not only have we got Serena with the details, but then we've got Nick Humphrey, haven't we, the aviation lawyer?
Yes, and he explains the more legal side of it, about explains the wording of the document and what it actually means.
Now, one of the big stories today is, of course, the anniversary of the Beirut port blast. I'm afraid that the economic situation there has gone from bad to worse over the past 12 months. We crossed live to Beirut this morning, spoke to Ziad Hayek, veteran Lebanese banker. He's been an insider within the government for many, many years. His take on the situation there, but I'm afraid it is not particularly encouraging. Finally, though, I love this one. Tom spotted this story. Masdar is making water out of thin air.
Yes, and they mention about purifier and how you can purify as wasting water. So now they've used that technology to make water out of air.
It is. It's brilliant. Steve Severance from Masdar has all the details. They're doing it on a commercial scale, which is new and interesting. All that to come. First up, though, as we mentioned, here is Serena Kelly.
Ask Serena.
Serena Kelly has joined Richard and myself here in studio. Morning, Reem.
Morning, guys.
Right, lots of questions coming through, and they are all related to you know what. So we might use them, if that's okay, to find out more about these travel restrictions or not, as the case may be. So let's dive into them. Serena, with regards to the travel allowed from India, Pakistan, etc., do you know if this is long-term and only for a window of time?
No, they haven't clarified that. Obviously, the announcement came yesterday, comes into effect tomorrow, August 5th. So this is what is currently the situation. And again, as we've all experienced, things can change in a matter of moments. But effective tomorrow, the UAE has expanded the categories of travelers allowed to enter the country from countries that were previously banned. And again, as you mentioned, India, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, Nepal, Nigeria and Uganda. So right now, you can expect things to proceed as we've been talking about as of from tomorrow.
Shiraz has been in touch with us as well, saying, morning, Serena. Can you please tell me what to do if my daughter, who's in Pakistan, but her visa has expired at the moment? Do you know whether she's eligible to come back or not?
If she's had, if she's eligible of age to have been vaccinated and was vaccinated in the UAE before going away, because you do need to have your both doses of the vaccine, and it should have been administered here in the UAE. Otherwise, you do have the unvaccinated exempt categories as well. Medical professionals, students studying in the UAE, she would fall under that category, hopefully, as well. My suggestion is, depending on the visa validity, just get on to the Federal Authority for Identity and Citizenship website. Because as we've previously experienced from last year, when people were outside the country needing to get in, you'd apply through the smartservices.ica.gov.ae website. You can find that on the Aaron News Centre if you need the link. You would have to apply there to get the permissions to be able to return. So a similar situation or system is in effect from tomorrow. So my advice would be for her to get online and just go through the motions of putting the documents in and applying, and then waiting for the approval, because that's really the only way to do it.
Another one that's come through. If someone has been vaccinated with an approved vaccine outside of the UAE, is that going to count?
See, this is a bit of a debate in the Aaron News room at the moment, because obviously we had previously announced where they were saying that they would accept vaccines that were sort of recognized or approved by the UAE. those vaccines, Pfizer, BioNTech, Oxford, AstraZeneca, Sinopharm, Sputnik V and Moderna. And they also mentioned Covishield because that is the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine manufactured by the Serum Institute of India. The change here is from the announcement made yesterday, they have it's all in the wording, and that they have specified that you will need to have been inoculated in the UAE. So it needs to be that you've had both fully vaccinated, both jabs, and it was done in the UAE. And that is you can take a look at NSEMA, but that it's down to the wording that they've used. So that would be, unfortunately, I don't feel that it would be the approved vaccines, but it is something that the team is going to try and look into.
Jerome been in touch with us as well. Jerome asks this one. Morning all, especially Serena. With the new travel announcement done yesterday, with regards to the ICA permit to re-enter, is that required for everyone or only for the newly open countries on this list?
No, it would only be specific to the inbound flights that were banned. So we've mentioned the countries, India, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, Nepal, Nigeria, Uganda. It is specific to this situation. It's anything outside that realm, it's not required. But in the past, they have said to please make sure that all your details with regards to status, visa, everything is up to date through the Federal Authority for Identity and Citizenship. But otherwise, this only applies specifically to what we've been talking about this morning.
Rajan Oraj is appealing to the fourth emergency service. His text message starts with SOS, SOS, SOS. Serena, help. My friends. Okay, this is... You got your pen out.
Why? Do I have to do maths?
My friends are currently on a quarantine trip in Baku.
Okay.
Return flight is on the 8th after completing 15 days in Baku.
Okay.
From the subcontinent, meets all the criteria to enter the UAE. Can they enter on the 5th or the 6th, since the ban has now been lifted? Urgent, as they have pressure from their job. Appreciate it. That's from Raj.
Because these new guidelines are in effect from tomorrow. So if you meet the criteria, then there's no reason why you can't return from tomorrow.
Yeah.
It's as long
as you need to apply for permission.
Exactly. So you need to go through all the procedures. You need to visit the smartservices.ica.gov.ae website, apply. You've got to wait for the permissions. You need the relevant PCR testing before you board. Can't be more than 48 hours old. You need to have a valid residency visa, have been inoculated in the UAE. Otherwise, if you're unvaccinated, as long as you fall into one of those categories, medical professional, student, you're teaching, working in the education sector, humanitarian case, you work for the government, a federal entity, or you are receiving medical treatment in the UAE, those categories don't need to be vaccinated. Otherwise, you do.
Morning, Serena, from David. This one, the whole family have just recovered from COVID. How does my son, who is a tourist, get the clearance certificate from Sahar now? This one's from David.
As a tourist, I'm sure that they would. It depends if he's also been registered online. I suppose if you just go to, if it's Sahar Abu Dhabi or the DHA, they would be able to provide that for you. You just need to contact the relevant authorities. I think Sahar's 800 17 17, DHA 800 342. Just reach out to them. They should be able to guide you with regards to that, getting the clearance certificate.
Another question that's come through for you. You're being bombarded, quite right, too. Serena, are unvaccinated 12-year-old children returning from India with a vaccinated resident parent allowed back in, or must the child also be vaccinated?
They haven't specified, but again, I suppose in the regards of being 12 and over, 12 and over is eligible to be vaccinated here in the UAE. So that would, you would assume it would apply, but I don't want to make assumptions. That's something we can try and get some clarity on. But yes, you would think that 12 and above, you would need to be vaccinated unless you fall into the exemption categories that, you know, you have a pre-existing condition or and then you'd need that certificate to say that you weren't able to receive to be vaccinated. But it is something we can try and check for you.
Faisal's been in touch as well, saying, look, I've got a question for Serena. On flights from Pakistan to India, can residents currently in the UAE now travel to these countries or not?
Pakistan to India?
UAE to Pakistan or India.
So the flights are going...
Are there flights now available for people to fly from the UAE to Pakistan or India?
They'll be going... Well, they have been travelling. They've been doing transit and also cargo. So, and they'll be going now to be able to try and bring people back. But there's always been repatriation, as in flights have been leaving the UAE, so people could... could go.
Just no guarantee of coming back.
Exactly. That's the
so
issue.
So there are flights available from the UAE to Pakistan and India for those that want to repatriate.
Exactly. But now you've got these conditions in regards to being able to come back.
Right, we are. Just scratched the surface. Got loads more for you.
If people want more information, check out the ARN News Centre app.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Right, moving on to one of the big talkers of the day, and loads of questions coming through on this one, and with good reason as well. We have seen so many occasions of travel being restricted around the region and around the world, and more so than here in the UAE. So when you get news that the UAE is going to ease travel restrictions from six countries on its flight ban list to allow some residents who are stranded abroad to fly back to the Emirates, it is welcomed with a huge amount of optimism. However, how is that going to translate? The government has said that all vaccinated individuals, as well as unvaccinated people in certain job categories, can seek permission to return from tomorrow. The decision includes people who are in India, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, Nepal, Nigeria and Uganda, according to the state news agency WAM. Let's get the latest on this one and dive into the small print with one of the partners at Kennedy's, Nick Humphrey, who joins us live on the line. Morning, Nick.
Good morning, Tom.
Good to have you on board. Thanks so much indeed for being with us and also live, as you can see, on Microsoft Teams. First and foremost, your reaction to the news overnight. How much of a game changer is this?
Well, I guess your use of the word ease is probably the one we need to focus on here. Now, it's a good step, but I think... You know, there's a lot of people that will be stranded in those locations, in particular working categories in the UAE that will still be prevented from coming. And if you have a look at even the Twitter responses, there's so many questions of people in very desperate situations wanting to get back. So I guess from those people's perspective, it's not going to be immediate relief, but it is a good sign that steps are being taken to, you know, hopefully in due course get them back.
So a step in the right direction then, because as you mentioned there, the wording is up for debate, isn't it? The wording can be interpreted in a number of different ways.
Well, yes, it's quite interesting how, I guess, during the course of this pandemic, certain information is released, it seems, on Twitter by the federal authorities, and it seems then everyone is scampering to determine what certain words and terminologies mean. I guess within this, there's two broad categories if you look at. One is the UAE visa holders. And I guess the first condition for those particular UAE visa holders in particular categories of work is that they need to have been vaccinated in the UAE. Mm. So that's one of the conditions. There's probably a lot of people who have been vaccinated, for example, in Pakistan and India whilst they've been waiting to get back. So they might be struck off that immediate condition. Then you've got the categories of people that it applies to, medical workers, educational sector, students, and then there's others, for example, if you work in the government. And then there's the steps involved in getting here. And the other broad category, which is a lot broader, is transit traffic. So since the issuing of this particular Twitter update by the NCEMA yesterday, the airlines have updated their information to say, look, they are working towards, one, implementing flights to address that initial category, and two, setting up flights for the transit traffic for these a whole lot of other countries, including the likes of Bangladesh and Afghanistan. There's Vietnam and there's a few other countries. So if you look at those broad categories, and then I guess it would be an interesting conversation with the airports, because how they're going to manage that transit traffic, given, I guess, there still must be a categorisation that there remains a large risk with those particular countries.
It's interesting as well, isn't it, Nick? Because, as we were saying here on the show this morning, a lot of hoops to jump through, a lot of boxes that need to be ticked in order for you to qualify for this. And that's before you've even got permission, because you still have to apply for permission to travel.
That's correct. So there needs to be some sort of a permission that you go through. I always get these terms of the federal departments wrong. So it's the Federal Authority for Identity and Citizenship. There needs to be a certain approval through that. I guess they will verify that against the visa that you hold and the category of worker that you are, if you're fulfilling that particular condition. And I guess, like all of these things, they're very fluid. So no doubt there'll be initial teething issues, and once the process gets going, there'll be a lot more clarity. But I guess it's when these things happen, and particularly when it's fed onto Twitter, you have and I'm sure, you know, you guys are going to be inundated with a lot of questions from very desperate people and people who want to see their families today.
Already getting those through at the moment, Nick, and it's interesting because I think a lot of people are taking this new, you know, taking it with a pinch of salt in terms of the happy to take the positive step forward, if you like, but very conscious of the fact that it is not a guarantee of people returning. But all people need at the moment, seemingly, is that given, restrictions came in place mid to late April for India, Sri Lanka, Pakistan, Nepal, Bangladesh, early May or thereabouts. People have been stuck behind borders for quite some time now.
Yeah, it's incredible. If you look at the, you know, global country pairs in aviation, India and the UAE is one of the largest trafficked and flight routes in the world. And it has, you know, pre-pandemic, there's over 1,000 flights a week. That's a lot of traffic. There's a lot of connectivity between the UAE and India, the UAE and Pakistan, and they're very important markets. And, you know, the Indians make up the largest proportion of expats. Visa holders in the UAE. So they're so connected, and you imagine the desperation. I guess one of the other elements to put onto this, and you know, look, you can compare the position that, you know, the UAE has in, you know, trying to get the approval of the UK to recommence flights there. The UK's approach is not very transparent. We don't know why they're letting some in and not others. And I guess on this approach, there's, you know, with this announcement, it's not, it doesn't come with information to say, for example, well, you know, things are easing. There's, you know, there's less infections. There's reasons why we're taking these steps. This whole period of time, and particularly within the aviation sector, it's been very much more divorced by clear information, which makes people in particularly those humanitarian positions, it's very difficult and frustrating.
You mentioned those questions, Nick. They are coming in thick and fast at the moment now. A lot of them asking the same question. Please, and I appreciate you might not know the answer to this, Nick, because you've read exactly the same reports as we have. But does Nick have any idea what will happen with those whose visas have expired while they are out of the country? Do they still qualify?
Well, interestingly, in this particular, the document that was on Twitter, the first sentence is, those with valid residency visa. So it seems that you need a valid residency visa to qualify. Mm. And there were, if we recall last year when I guess there were the mass lockdowns and people's visas did expire, there were some dispensations and flexibility provided by the authorities. Now, maybe that will apply in due course, but I guess if you read the strict terms of this, it uses the word valid residency visa. So if it's not valid, then you don't fulfil that category.
The other thing, again, and just from a personal reading of this one, again, great intent, great transparency, as you mentioned there. This is obviously a move, an attempt to move in the right direction. However, it is dependent not just on permissions, also flights as well. And there are certain countries within that list that were announced to us of the six countries that still have none to very few flights available from or to those countries.
Yeah, exactly. And interestingly, even with India, the regulator in India still has essentially a ban on international flights, but then it has these particular exemptions it will grant for certain countries. So the one thing is an announcement that's made yesterday, which will apply tomorrow. And, you know, airlines can't suddenly, you know, there's got to be a commercial case in this as well. They won't suddenly ramp up. We do know, for example, given the importance of the cargo flights in these particular markets, there are likely to be passenger aircraft that are being used solely for cargo at the moment anyway. But, you know, airlines themselves need lead time on this. They need to get bookings and organise and get their own protocols in place to make sure that they're adhering to the regulators' requirements.
We will take the good news. We will watch this space with interest and we will keep updating you throughout the rest of the day. Nick, really appreciate your time this morning. Thank you very much indeed for joining us live. Nick Humphrey is a partner at Kennedy's, an aviation expert, joining us live on the line, giving us his thoughts on that announcement from the UAE authorities to allow in more travellers from six red-listed countries last night.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-sized Business Breakfast.
We turn our attention now to the situation in Lebanon. It is sadly 1 year to the day since the Beirut port explosion that killed at least 218 people, 7,500 injuries and $15 billion in property damage. It left an estimated 300,000 people in Beirut homeless. Joining us on the line now to give us some perspective on the financial and economic implications of this, I'm delighted to say, is Ziad Hayek, veteran Wall Street banker and someone who knows the insides of Lebanon's economy intimately. He was for many, many years Secretary General of the Republic of Lebanon's High Council for privatization. Ziad, good morning. Thanks very much indeed for joining us.
Good morning, Richard. My pleasure to be with you.
So predominantly, we want to talk about the financial and economic situation in Lebanon at the moment, but we have to have a quick word on the human toll that it's taken on the city that you know, that you love, that you live in. What is the situation in Lebanon at the moment?
The situation, of course, is catastrophic, as you know. A year on, we still don't have a government. And there's really nothing that gives us hope in the near future anyway, because the same political problems continue to exist, and they are delaying everything. They're delaying even the investigation. There's a lot of interference in the investigation of what happened on the 4th of August. And we still don't have any answers as to who was responsible. On the human level, the toll has been catastrophic, truly, because in the first day, week, month, the problem was how to take care of the injured, how to take care of the reconstruction. Now, a year on, the problem is a psychological impact on so many people. It is the economic impact on their livelihood, and there has been absolutely no plan on the part of the government to take care of any of this. So people are left to their own. They have to fend for themselves without any assistance whatsoever.
If we look at the state of the economy at the moment, it was already highly challenged before the 4th of August 2020, wasn't it? Since late 2019, particularly a financial crisis with the Central Bank of Lebanon not having enough money to guarantee the currency. And that situation, I'm afraid, has got worse over the past 12 months, has it not, Ziad?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It has gotten worse. That we have less reserves now than we did before. There is less certainty also on the financial and economic and fiscal side as to what is going on. There are issues now relating to, you know, whether people earning their salaries in dollars, they pay taxes at what exchange rate, and, you know, all the problems of hyperinflation that you can imagine go along with that. So the average Lebanese citizen, or actually nobody, I should say, knows what the real value of the Lebanese pound is. And in the absence of clarity on that, nobody knows how to set their prices. That leads people to take the worst case scenario, and that in turn leads to hyperinflation.
Well, Ziad, I saw you on your Twitter account, which I follow just a few days ago, quoting The Economist and their famous Big Mac Index and looking at the price of a Big Mac in Lebanon, which I think is £37,000 today. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right.
What does that tell us about the plight of the average person in Lebanon? Can someone afford a 37,000 Big Mac today in Beirut?
Absolutely not. The average salary, £37,000, is basically today, you know, you would think it's a dollar something at the black market exchange rate. But in reality, people are still earning, especially the employees, are still earning their salaries in Lebanese pounds at the old rate of 1,500, not at the new rate of 20,000 plus. And so therefore, it is very difficult to for anybody to make ends meet. The average salary in Lebanon today is about $100 a month.
So let's talk about solutions, Ziad. It is a very challenging situation. No one is denying that. But you've spent the past two decades, certainly in Lebanon, looking at solutions, looking at ways to make things better. And certainly some of your work with public-private partnerships was focused on that. You say there is no government in Lebanon at the moment, and of course that remains the case, but there is a new prime minister designate that we read about, Najib Mikati. Are there some green shoots that we can cling to?
You know, it's very difficult for me to be optimistic today, unfortunately. The current government, the existing government, is a caretaker government. And whether there is a prime minister designate or not, it behooves the existing government to take decisions to, you know, alleviate the suffering, to take care of the people of the country. This existing government has not done anything for a year. Until Prime Minister Mikati forms a new government, we don't have any clarity on what his program is, what the future will hold in terms of actions, whether Lebanon is willing to be.
We're losing the line, I'm afraid, Ziad, to you. Now, we're going to have to leave it there, unfortunately. That is Ziad joining us on the line from Beirut this morning. Unfortunately, the line has broken, but we will get Ziad back on the line, I'm sure, in the coming days and coming weeks to have a look at the situation there. Ziad Haik, former banker, former government insider in Lebanon as well, on the severe challenges facing that country at the moment. But we will try and get him back on in the next day or two, because we were just getting on to potential solutions. And even though, Tom, I mean, the situation, no, you can't dress it up. It's very severe at the moment. You have to look at solutions. He's a solutions-oriented guy. The new Prime Minister Mikati, says he's already been on the phone to the United States. He's already been on the phone to the European Union about potentially getting aid. And that is one of the big building blocks that Lebanon needs to get right. Everyone would say this in terms of repairing the economy. Now, that aid will not be forthcoming. We know without significant economic and political reforms, but it is the first anniversary of the Beirut port blast.
It'll be interesting as well how the, again, I don't really want to call it an anniversary, it's an anniversary that no one wants to remember or mark, but at the same, in respect of the dead, the injured and the loss that the blast created, it is an anniversary that needs to be marked. It'll be interesting to see how it is marked. I know that there were words coming out from the government that they were going to try and, you know, didn't want it to become a sort of festival on social media or anything like that. They didn't want to be too much outpouring, and they just wanted people to sort of remember in their own way. And yet, you're looking at reports this morning, and again, people on the ground will know much better, is that Beirut is bracing itself for widespread demonstrations today to mark the anniversary of the explosion, but also to vent their anger of the situation at present, anger which is justified when you listen to Ziad there and some of the issues that those in Lebanon and Beirut, not just Beirut, but in Lebanon as a whole, are going through at the moment.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Now, suffice to say, look, my biology, physics, chemistry lessons were fairly rudimentary at school. Didn't really continue into further education, into A-levels or otherwise. So I'm not the best mind out there to get this one. But every now and again, you get one of these stories that you just are left scratching your head going, how on earth do they do that? This was one of them that broke a couple of days ago. News out of Abu Dhabi that is set to launch an innovative new project, a first of its kind in the world, where commercial volumes of an uninterrupted supply of water will be produced from a sustainable source. That source will see technology used to convert air into water. It's going to be undertaken down in Masdar City. The head of the program management at Masdar is Steve Severance. Joins us live on the line and live happily via Microsoft Teams as well this morning. Good morning to you, Steve.
Good morning, Tom. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, I'm glad you're here as well, because you're going to have to help me out with this one, Steve. How do you turn... Look, OK, I get that there is condensation, can be got from air, etc. But desert air, arid air, Middle Eastern air, how does it work?
Well, you're absolutely right. We do not actually convert air into water. What we're doing is taking the air out of the water, taking the water out of the air that's already there. So I think that everyone in Dubai or the UAE in general, at this part of the world, has walked out of their apartment building on a very hot day and watched their glasses just fog right up. Basically, that is the condensation, that is the humidity in the air, and that's what you feel. And especially desert air is very good for this because of the humidity we have here. So our air is actually quite water rich. So while this has been done at a small scale, you can actually buy units for your apartment, and we've been piloting this at Masdar City for several years to create drinking water in Masdar Park. So people have actually been able to come out and see this done through solar power. The difference is we're now doing this at scale and with a renewable energy source and creating 24/7 water. So 5,000 to 7 liters a day, 5,000 to 7,000 liters a day using renewable energy and on a 24/7 continual basis.
I suppose that's the element that's got me scratching my head the most at the moment is, yeah, you're quite right, be it condensation on your glasses, be it on shop fronts, etc., your car, when you get into your car of the morning as well. But these are minimal amounts. I mean, the press release suggesting commercial volumes and uninterrupted supplies as well. Is that achievable?
Absolutely. But that's what we're going to be testing. We want to demonstrate that this can be done. So this is the goal. And we've got two partner organizations in this, Aquavim, which is an American company, and Khalifa University, which is the leading technology university in Abu Dhabi, and actually came out of Masdar Institute, which was the very first institution that we built at Masdar City, because we knew the importance of having the scientists, having the researchers here. And so we've come together with these two different institutions, as well as another technology pilot project that we started last year, which was to produce renewable energy 24/7 using a Stirling engine. So storing the heat created by solar power and then using that to create electricity, and powering the water condensation 24/7 with renewable, and it will produce 5,000 to 7,000 liters a day. And this is really a test case to say, okay, it works on small scale. Can it work at a commercial level? And it's really what Masdar is about, taking pilot projects, taking small scale projects, building them up, and then sending them out into the world to actually solve what I would call the world's most pressing problems right now. And that is, how do we decarbonize our economy? And I think if you look at the headlines of any paper these days, outside of COVID, water is a major issue. It's a major issue, obviously, in this part of the world for years, but it's becoming an issue in almost every city, in almost every country, that we need to supply the water for the 7.8 billion people that are here, and we need to do it in a sustainable way. And this is a demonstration of a new, better technology. What we're really testing is a better condensing unit. How do we take more air out of the water using less energy? Because we've proven you can take air out of the water. I mean, way back in the 70s, when I was a child, we had a dehumidifier in the basement. We had no plan on using that water. We just wanted to make the house a more comfortable place to live in. But this is a chance to take that technology, scale it up, and be able to do it at commercial levels and to work on the economies of scale so we get the energy consumption down to a point that's sustainable.
Let's talk scale if we can, because obviously we know it's been well documented, the investments into food security here is at present. The same with water security, and we are in need of solutions today and, of course, for all of our tomorrows as well. How much could this potentially impact, not just on UAE or regional water security, but what implications could it have for global water security?
Well, I think that... For global water security, we need better ways of getting water, and we're running out of traditional sources. So this is a way of doing this without desal, because while desal has been very successful here and going to supply the vast majority of our water We need alternative sources, and we need sources with zero carbon. This is a zero source carbon. So while we're starting at 5,000 to 7,000 liters a day, and look, if you're looking at many countries around the world, you'll see about 100 liters per person in a day. We're a bit higher than that because of the climate we're in here. But this could be 500 to 700 people, and about the size of, this is modular 20-foot shipping containers. So they're easy to set up and be shipped around the world to solve the problem. Is it the full solution? No, but we think it, over the coming years, it could make a significant contribution to the problem. But first, let's get it up and running. Let's test it here. Let's demonstrate that it can be done. And I really think that's what Mavstar is about, demonstrating the limits of the possible, demonstrating what I think a lot of people, you mentioned earlier, this is impossible. Well, let's demonstrate we can do it and then scale it up.
What is the time frame on this one? When are you going to start the project, unless it's started already? And when can we potentially start seeing results?
Well, the energy system's in place, so we're already testing the energy system to see that works 24/7. It will be coming over. I believe it's in a shipping container right now as we speak, and it will be installed in sometime late September, October. So by the end of the year, we should start seeing results. And then over the coming months, and then we'll look at seasonal differences too, because the humidity here is different from time of year and time of day. So we'll look at how this works over the course of a year to see what we can actually produce.
And you and the team, Steve, confident, excited? Can it work?
Very excited. Very excited. Very excited because we believe in the technology, we believe in our partners, and we're excited that companies around the world are looking to come to Mavstar and say, hey, we want to demonstrate sustainability. We want to partner with someone who can roll this out. And they said, we want to be with Mavstar, and we want to be with Khalifa University, which is our research partner in this. We're thrilled by the validation globally of what Mavstar is doing and excited to take on one of the world's biggest challenges.
Good on you, Steve. Lovely to chat with you this morning. Thank you so much indeed. All the best to you and your team. Loving the projects ongoing, not just this one, but all the projects ongoing down at Mavstar. Steve is the head of program management at Mavstar, joining us live on the line. And Richard Dean, it really is. It has become a centre of excellence, has it not, for so many different projects?
They're doing some really, really good work down there. But in some ways, it's just applying old technology. I thought what Stephen said was interesting. When he was growing up, they had a dehumidifier in the room. They just got rid of the water. No one thought to use it. But the technology has clearly been around for decades. It's simply refining it and applying it and putting it to good use so we can put that water in a glass and clink it.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to DubaiEye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.